Welcome to The Red Room, a podcast for hackers, hopefuls, and red team operators, where we talk technical and hear war stories of artful hacking.
Welcome to The Red Room, a podcast of red team stories and technical conversations for anyone who likes the offensive side of cyber. The podcast is brought to you by Redacted Information Security. I'm Remy, and with me, as always, is Simon.
Hello. With you, as always, is Garth.
Great, great witty first opener. We pretty much always do three things each episode. We talk about a new technique or a technical concept which is spawned from the internet or in our brains, in this episode's case, Simon's brain. Then we have a chat with our guests about some of the stories they have from offensive activities they've undertaken or the tools they like to use. Before we leave you, we are then going to have a review of an open source red team tool. This week we have Covenant. Before we get into it though, a quick word of warning to people sensitive about swearing. Simon and I both spent some time in the military and now we swear a lot and we are not going to censor ourselves. So we're not even going to bleep it out or anything. The only things that get bleeped are semi-sensitive things, possibly about clients or big brands or things that got hacked. And maybe we shouldn't talk about how hard they got hacked.
Someone actually accidentally slipped the name of a big client in this episode. So,
but it's fine. You'll hear the bleeps. Our upcoming episode today, we have two guests. We have Naima and Nathan from Mercury Information Security Services. Mercury is a great friend of Redacted, and they have supplied these two excellent red teamers for us to poke. They're going to share with us some of their stories from their career and some of their thoughts on tools and how they like being in the red space of cyber. Before that, though, we're going to talk about potentially obfuscating implants that have been written using interpreted programming languages. And then after our chat with Naima and Nathan, we are going to talk about the Covenant C2 framework and give you a little bit of an overview. All right. First, let's start with Bright Idea. This one comes by the way of Simon's brain. Here I am stacking the dishwasher when Simon bursts through my front door, very Kramer style, and just starts explaining this idea. And it's basically, what if we were to rewrite the Python interpreter and the bytecode that is used in Python to try and obfuscate it? So just change everything up, right?
Yeah, so Python is sort of well-renowned for the speed with which you can dev things and for the stability of its modules. So it does sort of lend itself in that sense to being able to build malware or to be able to build implants, C2 implants with it, particularly given that most C2 implants, like when you write something like this, there's a ticking clock. It's an arms race between how long you can keep it running and how well you can obfuscate it before it starts getting detected, you know, or signatured too much. And then, you know, you have to put it out to pasture. But the thought, our initial thought was, Remy, when we spoke about this, our initial thought was, could we just change a bunch of keywords in the Python interpreter? Because the Python interpreter is written in C. Could we, for example, just randomize a bunch of keywords? So after we write some malware in Python, then look at the interpreter and just change a bunch of keywords. So change the for keyword and the while keyword, you know, to just random strings, and then ensure that our script is sort of adjusted, you know, updated accordingly. How well would that help in obfuscating a Python implant if we were to sort of package this Python script up with the Python interpreter into a standalone binary and then, you know, drop that onto a target system?
So you're saying that we would have to then change keywords in the program that we made. So we would change the interpreter so your for loop is the flibbity gibbet loop, the while is the flurgen, or whatever you want to make them. And then we program with that. So we make a flibbity gibbet loop and a flurgen loop and, you know, and everything becomes madness.
So that was sort of the first thought, you know. So yes, we would change all of those keyword aliases in Python interpreter, right? And then yep. we would recompile the Python interpreter. And then we would change all of those keywords to match within our Python script so that the interpreter actually knew what it was doing. And then we would package the whole thing up into a single executable binary, right? Which you can do with, you know, there's a couple of sort of Python tools that will do this for you, a Py installer and things like yep. that. Would this actually help us? Would like something, because that is extremely simple to do. This is something like we could basically do this with sed, And it didn't actually take much research into this because I'm not intimately familiar with the Python interpreter. I'm afraid to say the answer is no. It doesn't actually work at all. There's a technique, but what it did give rise to was perhaps an interesting CTF challenge that we can develop later. But what happens is what we collectively refer to as the Python interpreter is actually the Python compiler and the Python virtual machine, or the Python virtual machine and the Python interpreter kind of analogous with each other. But what happens when you run a Python script through the Python interpreter is that the Python script that you have written, the high-level language, is then compiled into an intermediary language called Python bytecode. And the bytecode is then executed by the interpreter, that is running on the host system, and the interpreter turns that Python bytecode into machine instructions. And the interpreter itself is, for all intents and purposes, a virtual machine. It's an abstraction layer between the bytecode and the machine instructions. And it's that virtual machine that allows Python to take care of all of that stuff that you have to do manually in other languages like garbage collection and that sort of thing. So what I actually found when I tested this out is that if you want to change aliases like that, I mean, you're quite welcome to do it. The aliases only relate, those keywords are only really important between the Python script and the Python compiler. Right? So when you compile, it's just going to compile to the same bytecode as it would have had you not changed those keywords. It becomes the same thing in the intermediary language. When, if you want to sort of decompile that bytecode, if we make malware out of this and then, it gets detected and picked up and someone tries to reverse engineer it and they go, I recognize this, it's Python bytecode and an interpreter jammed into a binary. They pull out the Python bytecode and they run it through effectively a decompiler, and these things decompile very well. And it would decompile back into sort of original Python source code without any of our obfuscation in place, because
it would turn them back from flibbity gibbet loops back into while and for loops.
But basically, yes. So the bytecode would be the same. Yeah, which actually leads to the somewhat interesting CTF challenge that we could then go ahead and make, I think, which is to do that, to create the flibbity gibbet loops within the Python compiler and provide this Python script that is just an absolute mess of random keywords and things like that. And, host perhaps a Python interpreter in a web service or something, which allows people to upload their flibbity gibbet code and have it interpreted, and then see how they would go about sort of deobfuscating something like that, with potential solutions being off the top of my head, as one of two ways, is that they could sit down there and decode it manually. Make sense of like, well, this kind of looks like a while loop, but it says flibbity gibbet, so we can sort of infer from that. Or you could try and write some flibbity gibbet code that actually dumps out the resulting bytecode, which you can do in Python. You can say, show me the bytecode of what these instructions would be, and then decompile that bytecode back into normal Python code.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. Could we change the bytecode? Could we go through and change it so that when it gets transferred into bytecode, we are applying the same obfuscation logic?
So we could. It could be done. It may be easier to write a new programming language than it would be to try and it would take some very in-depth and intimate knowledge of the Python compiler and the Python virtual machine in order to sort of change the resulting bytecode into something that is, not easily reversed.
The answer to deeply obfuscating Python is to make it not Python.
Yes, don't do it that way, right? So, I mean, if you wanted to obfuscate Python code, you could encrypt it. You could, but then you would need to attach the decryptor into your standalone binary, which it's interesting, but I think fundamentally not what we're after.
Yeah, a little bit flawed. I think the current use of like packers and like shufflers, where functions get shuffled around and things which introduce like crap loads of variables and interlinking functions.
That is an interesting thing. One thing that you don't actually have when you compile Python into bytecode is and to be read by the Python virtual machine into machine code, is that you don't have optimization, right? So what we have with you know, our sort of closer to the metal languages, your C and your C++ and Rust and whatnot, is that the compilers carry with them lots of like optimizations, which will help, you know, which does in one way helps to obfuscate your code, because like the way the human would write it is not necessarily the way that it is most optimal for a machine. So when reverse engineering, you know, this code that has been optimized doesn't always, you know, is not always apparent to the human behind the human reverse engineer what's trying to be done. But that being said, in Python or interpreted languages, you're free to create as many dead functions or, you know, random variables through your code as you wish, and the compiler will quite happily convert that into bytecode. You're now starting to get to quite a large piece of malware, because you have to cram the interpreter in there as well.
You have nine megabytes of crap just so you can hide that like 2.
Yeah, right. So yeah, shell. just as I want to dev up my malware quickly. So here's my 20 megabyte piece of malware that I'm going to jam into memory and hope that it never gets caught, right? Which I suppose it really depends on what your risk tolerances are for running your red team operation. And of course, there's other options. If you want to dev in Python, and something that I'd like to explore in the future is you could write it up in Python and be a good little programmer and do all your correct type annotations and whatnot, and then have it converted into C source code with Cython, and then, you know, just compile into straight C would be, compile from, you know, straight C code into a binary would be an interesting way of looking at things as well. And then of course you'll lose all your dead end functions, random things like that. But it's a small price to pay sometimes.
When I first heard this idea from you, I was like, damn, that sounds like it would really screw with, you know, most modern detection techniques. But it's almost a too good to be true thought, because somebody would have done it.
Surely someone's done this before.
Yeah, surely.
Like if it was possible. I suppose you could do is you could still do it. There's nothing stopping you from doing it. There's just somewhat little benefit. However, when you do sort of gather your Python source code up into a standalone binary with PyInstaller, at least, PyInstaller gives you the option as to whether or not you want to include your original source code into the binary as well, or whether or not you just want to put the Python bytecode in there. In one sense, you could perhaps, it's no more secure than any other red herring if you want to put your Python code with your flibbity gibbet while loops in there and have them find that and go, this is how I'm going to do it, and never look at the bytecode.
Yeah. Just fill it full of complete red herrings. That's not bad. I mean, ultimately it won't catch any, obviously, automated detection techniques, because they'll see right through that crap. But humans, definitely.
Yeah, indeed. And I'm also curious as to, you know, whether or not there's, you know, extreme benefit into trying to significantly, you know, rewrite the Python interpreter in this way when the Python interpreter itself is a well-recognized binary and probably less likely to flag on, you know, malware.
Yeah, it's, newness is often not what you want to try and achieve, right? In red team operations, you want to hide in the noise. You want to seem like you should be there. So yeah, definitely, it's probably even philosophically not worth doing, Simon.
Perhaps. Far from obfuscating, you know, by messing around with the Python interpreter, you can still just obfuscate in Python code. Is the short answer. There's nothing stopping you from just writing Python code that is almost impossible to read, and then having that almost impossible to read converted into bytecode as normal.
Absolutely. Our recommendation from this segment today is, dear listeners, keep doing what you're doing. Don't mind us.
Just carry on as you were, and I will never think of this again.
All right, let's go on now with our interviews with some hackers. Here today is Naima and Nathan from Mercury Information Security Services. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Can you guys give us a bit of a quick intro and a background on yourself and your team? Naima, can you give us a start?
Yeah, hi. My name is Naima. I'm one of the senior consultants at Mercury. I do a bit of both pen testing and GRC, so I double on the dark side. I started off in pen testing when I first started in Mercury and decided to move to the GRC team, I think maybe in my second year, just to see how things are run and done. And what I've realized while being at Mercury is that they both go hand in hand. And I don't think doesn't like to hear it because he's not keen on any GRC stuff, but I'm a huge advocate for all pen testers should be doing some GRC work and GRC should be doing some pen testing.
So just to be clear, GRC is the dark side from this perspective, right?
Yeah, we're the dirty team.
Yeah, that's great.
I think Simon has a lot of opinions about GRC, having been forced to do GRC, and as a red teamer, it's been a hard road.
I'm born to red team, but forced to IRAP.
Any of our non-Australian, non-government listeners are not going to understand what that is, and we're never going to talk about it because this podcast is not about GRC. I'm really sorry.
Okay, we'll just change it like the Harry Potter book. We'll just change the words like, you're born to red team, but forced to FedRAMP.
All right. That's enough of those dirty words. Nathan, can you give us your intro and background?
Yeah, no. Hi, I'm Nathan. I'm a principal consultant at Mercury within the Sage team, so we do a lot of architecture stuff. I started pen testing at Mercury and then moved more into the security architecture, the more cloud stuff. Like Naima said, not too fond about the GRC space, but heavily technical. Anything tech, I'm all over it.
Sick, that's what we like to hear.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to our first question. Naima, what's your favorite engagement? We're not talking GRC engagement here. We're talking red team pen testing engagement. It can be the most interesting, it can be the most hilarious, you know, whatever you think is your favorite.
I was recently put on an internal with one of my faves, shout out to Ollie, and this client had completely, like, it was the closest thing to the red team thing that I've been exposed to. You could walk on site, plug in anywhere, sit in the back room of like their factory warehouse and just do what you needed to do and no one would know that you were there the whole day. And it was, the gates were open from 9 to 5. Brilliant. We walked into their second location. We did the same thing. No one even questioned why we were there. Entire network was flat. No segmentation. You could hit everything and ping everything. Pretty sure we got DA within the first 2 hours of our day on that client. So it was pretty fun. It was pretty hectic.
How long was the engagement?
5 days.
5 days. The first 2 days, you got all of it.
Two hours. That was the length of the engagement.
Oh, sorry, 2 hours.
The 5-day engagement, but they had DA in 2 hours. So I think they can wrap this one early and knock to the pub.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was a lot of fun. Learned heaps from Ollie. Also had some time to do some Wi-Fi testing, a little bit of config, just a little bit of everything. So it was cool.
Right, so in this engagement, there was a physical red team aspect to that as well. So they were happy for you to try and get your way on site.
Yeah, so one of their gates were open like all the time. So we just walked in through the back, their side door, just anyone could walk in. Their factory place, anyone could walk in, and they had a bunch of open ports that people could just touch. And all you really needed was a high-vis vest, and you look like you belong.
Sounds like they were manufacturing.
So they had their headquarter office, and then right next door was their factory office, their factory site. And then we went to one of their storefronts, and it was pretty much the same thing. It's like, you know, just going, sitting there on a couch and then just plugging in.
Yeah, right. I did something. It wasn't similar because there was no physical aspect. It was actually much more of a, like, it's a gross blue team thing, but it was also manufacturing. But we were looking at all of the computers that ran all their OT machines, like just they were making all sorts of stuff. And, you know, these enormous machines running off these one, like, Windows 10 computer sitting off to the side. And I'd go onto it and I'd be like, what is TeamViewer doing on this machine? And I'm like, that's not on your internal list of things that you use. And they're like, oh, yeah, like, you know, the manufacturer of this machine needs to log into it and maintain it for us. So we just have TeamViewer on there. And I'm like, okay. And how do they connect to it? They're like, oh, they just call the factory foreman and he just like reads the code off the screen. I'm like, excellent. So good. So good.
See, the interesting thing about this is that, like, if you were to ask that client, you know, who do you consider your, you know, primary threats to be? Like what kind of risk profile are we attempting to address with this red team operation? I think the majority of them, if you were to say, like, do you consider, you know, physical access to your facility to be a significant risk? Most of them would come back and say no, right? They would say, like, because the conceptualization of the cyber risk or the information security risk is that it's some nebulous force out there that that we don't really like, we can't really reach out and touch, right? But when you get, forgive me for saying, but when you get a client that is bold enough to say like, yeah, okay, we're going to allow, if you want to try and get onto our premises, then we consider that to be, you know, within scope. And then you can do that and just absolutely wreck that organization within a matter of hours because you had a high-vis vest. I think it goes to show that no matter what your risk register happens to consider your primary risk to be, you can't afford to not address these sorts of things. You can't afford to sort of hand wave that stuff away. Isn't that right?
Yeah, 100%. The report was very thick for that one. We had a lot of recommendations to go to support exactly what you just said. I think it was more about them just kind of being smart and not actually being really tech savvy in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Another crazy, like, hectic thing we saw was just like desktops just being open. So then, you know, cool, Naomi can go create herself an admin profile to their logging and billing system. And I had access to all of that and all their customer information and orders and stuff. So I was just like, this shouldn't happen. Hopefully they've deleted it.
Yeah, terrific. And like with an engagement like that, where you say you were just sort of happy to, just, you know, they're happy to allow you to walk on site. What do you do at the end of that? So you've walked on site and you've gone ahead and just wrecked them. Is it now time to rinse and write up? Or do you know, you sort of back off and say like, okay, well, that was one way we managed to get in. We've still got 4 days and 6 hours left. Do we want to try another way and see if we can address some other attack vectors?
Oh, yeah. So we went and we asked for, hey, can you give us a user profile with very low permission creds and we can just see what we can see, like what's your share file like, what do you have stored there, stuff like that. We did a couple of different angles, like I mentioned, the config reviews, the Wi-Fi testing, because it was 4 days, we have to do stuff at the end of the day. And we saw, like, we tried to see if there was other different avenues that we could get DA instead of that first easy one-way path. Mm-hmm. Another cool one was their GPO permissions were just being a bit finicky and we can commit code to like kind of execute something. That was the second way we got DA. No, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, right. So finicky group policy objects that allowed you to just execute code.
Yeah, so any user that had an account could do it.
Right, terrific. Yeah, okay. It's party time in the factory, right?
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, I mean, that I can see why that's a favorite engagement because you get to do everything, right? Just like, hey, it's open slather. Everybody have a turn. A little birdie did tell me you did a particularly good one with some Salesforce. Now, I don't know if it's sensitive and you don't want to talk about it, but
no, it's fine.
I was assured that was a pretty good one too.
Yeah, so that was like, I think it was 6 months into pen testing at Mercury. And it was a Salesforce app that we had to test for customers to buy passes. I was stumped. I was like, Ed, day three, bro. I don't know what's going on. I feel like there's nothing there. Am I not seeing something? And he was just like, look at business logic flaws. And that was it. That's the only hint he gave me. And he threw me up into the deep end. I was like, shit. Somehow we figured out that we could extend a 30-day pass for 20 years for this specific client. And that would have cost them like $20,000, $30,000, like a lot of money. And that we could manipulate other little fields in their Salesforce app just like that. And they were just like, whoa, no other client has picked this up in previous pen tests.
Yeah, right. So they were selling passes for like, I don't know, presumably, you know, snow lift passes,
hundred.
Whatever.
Yeah.
And they were a couple of $100. And then, you know, anybody who was filling in the forms could just be like, I want this to be 10,000 years. And then it'd just be like, no worries. Have your 10,000 year lift pass or whatever they were selling. That's pretty good. Yeah. Also, focusing on business logic. Getting back into like sometimes your threats aren't really like, you know, the high tech problems. They're really just the way you go about things.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, great stories. Thank you so much. Nathan, what about you?
Yeah, so I've been on quite a few interesting engagements. The one I'm probably more allowed to talk about, I was on an engagement. We got initial access by Wi-Fi. So their corporate Wi-Fi was just a PSK, cracked the password easy enough. We got on the network, we ran Responder. So shout out to Responder, man in the middle, favorite tool. So we got a hash and then we noticed that it was NTLM V1. So from then, we just passed the hash, found a computer that DA, the domain admin, was logged on, found that within half an hour and just hit the DC, created myself an account with admin privileges, and then that was all within probably half an hour to an hour. quickest way to DA I've probably ever done. But the more interesting bit is how the externals, the outsourced SOC, handled the compromise. So it was the day after I got compromised. So I got DA, then found some other paths to domain admin. So I did some RCE on a few other hosts. The SOC, the day after, reported to the client saying that, hey, we saw some informational disclosure at this time, which was actually hours after I have left the office. So I was like, hey, that wasn't me. I'm like, what's going to happen if you found an information disclosure? Can you give me more details? So the SOC ghosts us, doesn't respond to the client, doesn't want to provide us with what actually happened, any logs or anything. They just said information disclosure hours after you left. So like, cool, how about we do a bit of instant response on the network while we're doing our testing? We didn't see anything too much. So days later, the client's trying to contact the SOC properly, trying to get us more information because we've got logs of all the commands we run. And I think it was like about a week later, they were like, hey, yeah, it was actually at this time. We got it wrong. And I'm like, well, this lines up to a remote code execution. Yeah, kind of be informational disclosure. However, it's not exactly an informational disclosure. It's remote code execution. Like, you need to actually say that if you want to be, if you want to provide accurate logs to the client.
Okay, right. So, yeah, a few interesting things going on in there. So you said you gained access through cracking the pre-shared key on the Wi-Fi. Like after cracking that key, there was no restriction to you just jumping on
flat network. Network.
Yeah, oh, another flat network. Yeah, terrific. And then through Responder, you managed to, you said you grabbed a hash off the wire. So I think I might have missed a step in the middle. So that was that a DA hash that you grabbed?
No, so well, that was a normal user account. And then from the normal user, I was able to use pass a hash because it was NTLM v1.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
On the network, I just found a computer that also had a domain admin logged in. And then I just dumped the SAM.
Okay, yeah, terrific. Just so dumping registry hives off that local machine. If you don't mind me probing, how were domain admin creds extracted from local hives?
A domain admin was signed in to the computer as usual, and I dumped the SAM. So I was able to get all the NTLM hashes on that computer. And then from then, I just did pass a hash to compromise the domain control and create myself a user account with domain privilege.
Sure. Doesn't the SAM registry hive only store local user hashes?
Am I thinking of LSA then?
LSAS process memory, perhaps?
Yeah, so that must be it. My apologies.
No worries. Like part of the thing that I'm really looking forward to about this podcast is like poking into some of these techniques. And I'm sure Remy shares my view on this, is that for those of us out there who hear stuff like this and are like, wow, that sounds really cool, I do like sort of poking in and clarifying these things, you know, for the sake of everyone's learning. That is still, I mean, that's still a great result, right? As you said, look, security for this organization doesn't seem particularly strong so far with, you know, no restrictions on joining the Wi-Fi from, you know, sort of WPA pre-shared key. And then from there into grabbing a user account hash and then jumping on a host and then dumping some either process memory or wanted to get further hashes. And then you did mention, and of course, the NTLM version 1 hashes. So pass the hash is the technique that will never die. It's been kicking around forever and a day. And you mentioned sort of, and again, this may be probing a little bit too far into the engagement, but you mentioned just sort of getting some RCE across the network. So was this just executing code through like remote, like using domain admin credentials to remote execute?
I was using because the reason for my remote code execution was to find different avenues to DA. So I was probing the DC, I think, or one of the computers with Impacket PSExec.
Yeah, yeah. So PSX exec-ing across with your credentials.
Yeah, with the normal credentials that I obtained. And that was it. That was the log that the SOC picked up.
None of the other stuff that you did. So presumably you ran Responder with, again, feel free to decline to answer if we're probing a little bit too close into it, but presumably you're ARP spoofing or something like that with Responder to pick up anything, or were you doing some other technique? At any rate, at some point you've man in the middle, especially, and the sort of remote SOC didn't pick up your man in the middle activity. But they were tracking PSXEC, which is, for all intents and purposes, a legitimate system administrator tool. Like, PSXEC is part of the sysinternal suite.
Yeah. It's probably the command I ran that it picked up, because obviously I wasn't running a normal command. But they also didn't pick up on a user account getting created with also admin privileges. So some random admin account just pops up, like, yeah, no worries.
Yeah, terrific. So another interesting thing. So out of yours and Namer's stories, the one thing that's sort of consistent between the two of them is that we're looking at the wrong things. Like, defenders are looking at the wrong things, or at least not completely looking at the right things.
Yeah.
I think also maybe there's a bit of a saturation in the market of outsourced SOC happening at the moment. And I think not all outsourced SOCs are created equal. Please don't try and kill me. Any blue team is listening to this. But I feel like that's a consistent vibe as well. I have a question about cracking the pre-shared key. So you captured an authentication.
A handshake.
The handshake? Okay. Because I'm like, did you just brute force that, as in just started smashing that wireless access point, and even those 1 million requests didn't trigger the SOC? Or?
No, I didn't use anything like that. So I use, from memory, usually HCX dump tool. I captured the handshakes. I didn't do any clientless attacks. From memory, I usually would have tried that, but it was just a pre-shared key that I captured.
Were you outside their office?
Car park.
You're in the car park. Yeah, classic.
Wi-Fi, yeah, car park, just laptop on the center console, just chilling.
Do you recall if you de-authed to get that packet, or were you just waiting for people to arrive at work?
I wouldn't de-auth straight away. It depends. So my first is, can I see any host just connecting, people walking around? They had a couple of different access points, and then I would have, but I don't think I did need to de-auth from memory.
Yeah, I mean, you can either de-auth or you can just wait.
Yeah.
Right, eventually someone has to authenticate to the network. And
yeah, exactly. And like you said, yeah, wait, get in early, wait outside, or yeah.
Yeah, especially if mobile devices are, part of this organization's ecosystem, then their mobile devices are going to link into the work network when they bring them into the office.
Another commonality was, how quick it was. Like, how long was your engagement, Nathan?
Mine was 5 days in total. And obviously that was all on the first day, probably before lunch.
Yeah, what'd you do with the other 4 days?
Like you said before, we just try and find different avenues. They had a few other issues, the company, like account of ex-employees. Obviously that's not, you should be disabling ex-employees' AD accounts.
So their AD account's still active?
Yeah, because their reasoning was it turned into a service account, but they didn't change the password. So you shouldn't be doing that in the first place, but at least, yeah, change the password.
So a service account, like a sort of like a de facto service account, is this a user account that's just, the only thing it does now is run services?
Whatever service they were doing, yeah.
Outstanding.
So I know that you shouldn't, this is back in the days of, I used to teach Server 2008 R2 domain administration, and Microsoft used to tell us in the books, don't ever delete accounts.
Yeah. Right?
Back then, there was only several hundred million or whatever it was. I can't remember how many, but there was only so many SIDs that you could have in a domain, and then you would have to re-roll the domain. Since 2012 came out, it's now, there's trillions. It's almost infinite. But they used to say, yeah, never delete accounts, right? That was what Microsoft told everybody to do. I've heard, of these domains being full of 5 million accounts. The large orgs have been around for a long time. 5 million accounts, which are still disabled. I've never, ever in my life heard of somebody being like, oh, this person that's just left, yeah, new service account. Like, why are you doing that?
Well, I can only imagine that they were running some kind of application as part of their daily job while they did work there. And rather than try and sort of migrate that application over to a proper service account, or so they've just left it running under that user account. Leave the password the same, set the password to never expire because now that's going to cause too many dramas.
There is such a thing as a managed service account. Why are users even running services? Like, in the first place, let alone users that aren't there anymore.
Well, this network was, like, years old. Not much was patched. Whatever they do, they do it.
I think we can safely stop yelling about this now. Let's move on. Yeah.
Two great stories, right?
This is why we do it. Yeah. For the lols. What about you, Nathan? You got a good bug?
Yeah, I've got a few, but I'll say this one. So I found a bug in a web app that handled Orph a bit differently. It looks like their custom one that they wrote. So the headers themselves had, like, not exactly a hash, but like hash/encrypted kind of password in the actual header itself, with an extra letter at the start, which is, I think it was like S:password, encrypted password. So notice that, and then you can actually use the hash or the encrypted header. You can just copy and paste, remove the first two characters, boom, authentication works. I found stored XSS, so anyone that browsed to that page, headers back to my server.
That's good. So stored XSS that was basically sending you credentials.
Yeah.
What it sounds like here is two fundamental problems, right? Mm. Is what it sounds like to me without even looking at it. The first one, quite clearly, is they're using sort of the password derivation as a header, right? So you put in your password and it whatever does, like it's whatever hashing function, but they're using that in a header, right? So either as like a session token or something like that, or was it a header field or a header value?
Value.
Right. So it might be used as like a session token or some way to track user session.
I think that was, yeah.
The thing is that it also authenticates, right? So being able to use the password hash to authenticate leads me, and I've seen a bug like this before, is when the hashing of the password is being done client side.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's why I suspect as well.
You go and type your password in, calculates a password hash in browser, and then it fires off the password hash to the server, and the server checks the hash against the stored one in the database. But however, if you do it that way, you have made the hash the password. Then using it as a HTTP header value is, wow.
Yeah, not the best. Not the best security.
Did this site have TLS on it? Were you within a TLS session when you're interacting with it?
I think it had maybe TLS from memory, maybe like 1 or 1.1.
We don't even have browsers that support that anymore.
This was a couple of years ago, though. This was a year or so ago, yeah.
Why would you encrypt a person's password client side and then send it to the application when it's already encrypted? You're already encrypted session. Like, that's what your TLS is for, right?
It's just bad coding. That's what it is. It's just someone like, well, we can save some server compute by doing this in the user's browser. That's outstanding.
I guess so.
And that's why we're here to point these issues out to make sure they stop doing that.
That's a good bug. And then the XSS just on top of it is
just a little sprinkle of
give me all your hashes.
That is very tasty. I doubt you actually committed the effort into doing it, but did you ever figure out what hashing algorithm they were using client side?
No.
We could probably just read the JavaScript and find it there. Yeah, that's a good bug.
That's a great one. In the interest of time, I'm just going to keep powering through this because it seems like we all like to laugh about terrible security. Nathan, again, what do you like about working in offensive security? What's the best part? What's the best bit out of all of these bits? It doesn't meet the expectation that you had before you started, because everybody comes out of their degree, their cert for their CompTIA, whatever the hell you do, then they're like, yeah, I want to be a hacker. Everyone wants to do red teaming. So, did it meet your expectations? And what's the best thing?
Definitely, it met my expectations and more. The reason why I like offensive security so much is it's a challenge about a topic I'm interested in, because every engagement is different. There's so many different ways, this skin a cat kind of thing. So you're going into an internal, a red team, or whatever engagement you're in, this is a new challenge there's nothing better than getting DA after like days of trying X, Y, Z kind of thing. And then you finally off some obscure thing, some little thing that wasn't configured correctly, you got DA.
That sounds fantastic, but it also doesn't sound like your MO. All I'm hearing is 2 hours to DA and everyone go home.
Yeah, you guys are spoiling Ed with all this 2 hours to domain admin. Ed being, of course, Edward Farrell, Director of Mercury Information Security.
Shout out to Ed. Not to toot his own horn, but he is the best boss without a doubt.
That's good. The challenge the challenge is definitely, I think, what a lot of people talk about, because you're right. Instead of being a blue teamer, you're watching the same environment day in, day out. It's the same thing. You're trying to fix the same problems all the time. Mm. Instead, you just get to hop from thing to thing, just smashing away at other people's buildings, just being like, yeah, this is mine now. See you later. Goodbye. I've wrecked everything.
Your problem to fix. No, obviously, we give recommendations and stuff like that for any potential clients.
Yeah, I can see why everyone wants to be a red team.
Maybe look at your logging solution, because that sounds interesting.
What about you, Neymar?
I think it's Mercury, honestly. Ed is brilliant. It's kind of the only reason why I kind of want to stay. And everyone I work with, Ollie, like everyone in between. Yeah, and everyone in between. I think the team is just great, and they're always encouraging us to learn. And like, I still get to do both GRC and pen testing when I want to. If I say, put me on an internal, they'll put me on an internal. But if I want to review documents, they'll be like, go review a document.
Good culture is always, yeah, keeps people in what they want to do. Does it meet your expectations before you went into this?
Oh, it exceeded it. I had a very shit time at uni doing my master's in cybersecurity. I was ready to go back to my science community because that's where I originally came from. I did a bachelor's in chem and I was like, let me go do a PhD in some medical micro, like immunology type of shit and like leave this place. But Ed came and scooped me up and I said, you're the best. Let me stay. And just the sense of community that I've seen at like DEF CON and meeting all the other Aussie pen testers and what they've created and how inclusive that environment is, 10 out of 10.
I have to agree with that. I can't speak too much for the international community. A little bit I can, but the Australian security community is one of the most accepting and inclusive and inviting communities I've ever been a part of.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's just—
Can I ask which you is really what this was when you made the switch to cybersecurity?
I was speaking to a fellow pen tester, shout out Anthony, and he, after I finished my degree, I was just kind of lost. I'm like, I don't know what I want to do next. And then I spoke to him a little bit, went on holiday, had an eat, pray, love moment, applied to a bunch of other degrees. I was like, should I do medical school? Should I do nursing? Should I do something else? And he said, just apply for this. And I applied for it. And then I was like, he was like, stick to it. And I stuck to it. And it just kind of sold me on like, you're always learning, is you're not stuck in like a mundane cycle. And that's what I realized, like, I do like learning. And this is a job where I get to learn every single time.
Yeah, great.
All right. Neymar, do you have any tips or tools that you really like? Like, what is the thing which you're just like, yeah, this works every goddamn time?
Tool is a good question. What are your favorite tool?
The group chat, Mercury group chat, put me on Nuclei recently because I fell off a bit just doing GRC engagements and they were like, none of your stuff's updated. Recon FTW, Nathan put me on that, which is pretty cool. I know for internals, it's a bit pricey, but Rumble Run to like kind of map the network.
What is Nuclei? I don't think I've heard of it.
I've only used it once, if I'm honest. It just kind of shows you what exploits or what vulnerabilities that endpoint has.
It's a template vulnerability scanner. So you can pull templates from other people, but they also got like a pretty good repository. I find it best for like web apps and stuff.
So you basically just write your templates in this YAML yep. file, and like there's a community of people who build YAML templates for Nuclei, and you can just throw it against endpoints.
Yeah, exactly. Just type in Nuclei GitHub, you'll find a million.
Yeah, right, okay. Because I did just Google briefly just then Nuclei, but obviously there's many things that are also Nuclei. My Google foo is not good. So that's good. Good recommendations. What about you, Nathan?
Like, there's a million tools I use on every engagement, but the best one, it's an oldie, but it's still good, Metasploit. You would be surprised how many companies are still vulnerable to exploits that are like years old. I think it was last year or end of last year, beginning of this year, I found Internal Blue.
Oh yeah, classic. It's the gift.
Yeah, the classic. Giving, right? Yeah, so like the first hack the box you do, you know, still alive.
That's right. So do you find yourself using Metasploit like as an exploit tool sort of exclusively, or do you use it because it has some sort of limited C2 functionality as well?
Yeah, so I'll use Meterpreter and MSM Venom. I use a whole bundle. So depending on the network, if we have time, I would try and set up a C2 like Sliver. But if it's just like an internal engagement and stuff, I find just Metasploit, Meterpreter, that whole bundle is easy enough to use. And then obviously Impacket, Crackmap, Exact, and another shout out to Responder.
Yeah, great. A shout out to Rapid7 as well for Nathan's love of Metasploit.
Yeah.
Maintain the aim.
Do you have a particular, like, because I know that, I mean, even if they're just running Defender, like they didn't actively uninstall it, it'll still pick up most like MSF Venom stuff. Do you have like an obfuscation engine that you use a lot, or?
There is, off the top of my head, I can't remember. There, we got automation tools. I recently just bypassed Defender with WinPiece. So another great tool for privilege escalation. Yeah, WinPiece, obviously on Windows, you got LimPiece and all that stuff. With WinPiece, I got a help with one of my coworkers, and it was just like removal of strings, and that ended up bypassing Defender.
Outstanding.
Classic. Simon once did a talk on just iterating through Defender Check and just removing anything that it finds. Defender Check, another great tool.
Yeah.
Defender Check, for our listeners, is it's a little binary that interfaces with Windows AMSI, the malware scanning interface. And it is quite handy for this purpose that Nathan was just talking about. So if you want to try and run WinPiece on target and you want to try and change the strings that are in the code in order to bypass detection, Defender Check will actually tell you which strings are being actively detected by Windows Defender. It'll actually point you directly to them so you can go and check them out. And as Remy said, I gave a talk a few years ago now on how we can get entire C2 profiles through past Defender using basically just iterating it constantly with Defender Check.
Or do you use Threat Checker?
Threat Checker, is that a good one?
Yeah, that's what I usually use. Threat Checker, trying to find it.
For the listeners, you might be able to hear Nathan's furious Googling.
Yeah, Threat Check.
Threat Check, the raster mouse tool. Yeah.
Yeah, all right. See, this is half the reason that we do this podcast, because we can just outsource all of our searching and dev to be like, hey, you tell us. You tell us what's good.
Well, goes to show that this was actually a few years ago that I gave this talk about, because Defender Check, just looking at the GitHub repository now, hasn't been touched in a couple of years, whereas Threat Check was updated 3 months ago.
And so it's good for AMSI as well. I had some issues recently on engagement where I could only load PowerShell script from memory off a separate server. So obviously using that to bypass AMSI was...
delightful. Is great.
Yeah.
All right. I think we're pretty much out of time. But before Nathan and Naima leave you, do you guys, Naima, you first, do you have any tips for people who want to get into red teaming, who want to get into pen testing?
You don't need a degree. Do not waste your time and your money. That's the one thing I will say. You can learn everything from the internet. A lot of the stuff is for free, except for the certs, which I still think is a little bit of a piss take. Yeah, go have fun and do what you can. And at the end of the day, if a child is being a menace on the computer, hacking onto their school programs to play games, then let them do that and just know that they're talented and not a degenerate.
I thoroughly agree with that. So as a person who's been on the other side of the hiring table, I would hire someone who tells me that they do CTFs every weekend before I'd hire someone who's just got a degree.
And you, Nathan?
I would say I'd recommend learn the fundamentals, understand how a network works, how server architecture works, and also dabble in programming. Understand before you run it. Understand how the exploit works. A, yeah, it's safety reasons, but B, you're also learning how different exploits work, and it's valuable. If you ever want to get into exploit development or more advanced bypassing techniques, understanding how exploits work, definitely.
Yeah, very much echoing Ricky Burke, who runs CyberSec People. He's always yelling at people at conferences saying, top three, networking, programming, Linux. Learn those. You'll be good in cyber and red teaming.
People just want to be that meme of that kid who's stepping up like eight steps, right? Straight to red teaming.
Yeah, one of my mates always says, a really good sysadmin is a really good offensive operator.
All right, thanks very much, guys. Thanks for coming on. It's been a blast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
No worries. Maybe we'll get you back on in a little bit if you got even more stories for us. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
What a great interview. What a great interview.
It was a great time to be alive.
It is. We just get to sit here and talk to other red teamers. Amazing.
It's a great time. Great day for Remy. Great day for Nathan and Naomi. It's a great day for Ed. Great day for Australia. It's a great day for the world.
So we promised that we would give you a review of an open source tool. And today we are reviewing Covenant. What is Covenant, I hear you ask? In the words of Cobber's GitHub readme, Covenant is a .NET command and control framework that aims to highlight the attack surface of .NET, make the use of offensive .NET tradecraft easier, and serve as a collaborative command and control platform for red teamers. Covenant is an ASP.NET Core cross-platform application that includes a web-based interface that allows for multi-user collaboration. So I think some of the key aspects of that description are very much, I've made a hacking tool, and it's definitely to highlight the attack surface of .NET. Nobody please come and sue me. But I think the real key part for us is it's made in .NET. It's a C# application. That's pretty much it at its core, as it keeps telling us throughout the platform itself. So the first thing I want to talk about is installation of Covenant, right? Because I don't know about you, but sometimes I've ended up in dependency hell trying to get things working on Kali or whatever else. This particular framework, one of the advantages that, again, the GitHub page touts about is that it is cross-platform, as well as the platform itself is cross-platform, as well as the implants themselves, and mainly because it's all written in C#. And so everything will work wherever .NET is present. Now, .NET doesn't necessarily ship with everything by default, but all Windows machines have it. They have to have it. And a lot of Linux machines and even Macs have them. And from my experience of running Covenant very recently, this is true. It is quite easy to install, and it is cross-platform. I had it working on a Mac OS with an M2 ARM processor inside of 15 minutes, which is really amazing considering nearly nothing works on M2 processors at the moment. Simon can give me shit about that later. But honestly, I've had much more trouble installing other C2 frameworks on just Ubuntu and Kali, which they're supposed to work on by default. So it gets a big tick from me in the ease of install and ease to set up.
Yeah, certainly. Like, it's a C2 platform it's been around for a few years now. It hasn't really been actively maintained in a few years.
No, a couple of years on the GitHub.
Yeah, a couple of years. So I think it's a solo project by Ryan Cobb from SpectreOps. Shout out to him. He's actually, I've met him before. He's actually a really nice guy. Yeah, and SpectreOps does some great stuff. And this sort of, playing around in .NET and, looking at the .NET, the security implications of .NET in Windows and things like that is right up SpectreOps' alley. That's where they do a lot of their really, really interesting stuff. I've taught some courses using Covenant before, sort of revisited it last night in preparation for this interview to check it out again today, to talk about it today. I was quite pleased to find that there's a Docker image to have it up and running.
Yeah, I saw that as well. They said that there's some gotchas though.
I had no dramas running it out of the Docker image. In fact, trying to run the base installation, I ended up running into some sort of light dependency hell with some rather old versions of .NET assemblies and things like that. Whereas, I had to install .NET into my Linux machine to have this up and running. And of course, .NET came with the version of some of these assemblies was about, three major revisions past the one that was required for Covenant. So I ran it out of a Docker instance, but yeah, it all came up quite well and nice and easy to get up and running.
So as it said in the description, the interface itself is using, ASP.NET, and it is a web application, which is nice. I have a very low tolerance for binary based like interfaces. The modern era is all about shoving things into the browser. So
yeah, HTTP is the GUI platform of choice. If it's not a command line tool, then make your GUI in HTTP and
absolutely
CSS.
And this interface is pretty good. It does have some super strange UX elements though. Like when I'm loading it and moving around in it, some of the buttons, like buttons that you think should be labeled differently, like just even changing appearances or making applying settings rather than having like the word apply or save, you'll have like the word edit. And I'm like, well, you're supposed to click an edit button before before you start editing something, not edit it, and then to save it, you click the edit button. It was just some strange UX elements, which leads me to the listeners, the listeners interface, Simon. When you make a listener in Covenant, you have this concept of you bind it to it. You have a bind port, and then you also have a connect port, right? And from what I'm reading in the documentation, the bind port is what the implant will bind to, and the connect port is what it's going to connect to and on your C2 server. But then it has some other stuff, like in the documentation, it says that, you know, the address that it puts into the implant is a combination of the connect address and the bind port, right? And I'm like, well, that doesn't seem right. And I don't know if that's just an error in documentation, but I found it very confusing to understand what the two differences between those ports are. Because they generally get pre-filled one port away from each other. But here's the thing, Simon. The UX prevents you from actually entering that number. You got to use a little up-down arrow. Have you noticed that?
I'm noticing it right now, actually, yeah.
Yes, it's got a little up-down arrow. So if you want to change the port that you're connecting to from port 80 to be like port 8000 or something like that, you got to click that little button 8,000 times. I mean, 8,000 times.
That's right, yeah.
Why? I don't understand that design decision. Why do they not allow you to write into that? That seems incredibly strange to me. Is it just my browser? Is it just because I was using Firefox? I don't know. Do other browsers work differently with the Covenant UX? But what possible reason does it allow you to set both a bind port and a connect port? That's the other thing that I don't understand, right? Because really, you should just be going for like an ethereal high port for what you're connecting from. Because it's incredibly suspicious to be like, yeah, I got traffic from port 80 coming outwards. Or is this setting the bind shell port? It operates in bind mode and reverse mode at the same time. Because presumably the connect port and the connect IP are for reverse shell. And the bind IP and bind port are if you're using it as a bind shell implant. That is my understanding from reading the documentation and from looking at it. But it's really unclear, and it doesn't let you not set one of them. You have to set both a bind and a connect, which to me is incredibly strange. So that's kind of like, strangely enough, that user experience is really the worst thing about Covenant, which is interesting because, you know, it says a lot about how good it is as a C2 framework.
So we're talking about like, when you talk about like creating a listener and has like a bind address and a bind port and a connect address and a connect port, is this just to, I mean, perhaps the term listener is not the best term for something like this, but it seems to me like this is the option to make a forwards connection into an implant, right? From your sort of C2 server here, your Covenant server saying like, well, you know, for whatever network security configuration that is set up within our target network, we can't get traffic out of it, but we can get traffic into it, so we can actually forward connect with our listener to our implant.
No, because if you want to make a grunt, so all grunts have to have a listener profile attached to them or it won't let you generate.
Yeah, that doesn't prohibit this.
To me, from documentation, it appears to be both. Like when you make a grunt, for our listeners, if you're not familiar with Covenant, which if you're still listening to this, you probably aren't, but a grunt is their version of an implant. My understanding is it is Covenant in the meaning of the Halo franchise, in that you have grunts are the lowest of soldiers in the Covenant army. So grunts are what they call their implants. If you want to generate a grunt, you need to have a listener, right? You can't have just a bind or a connect port and address. You have to have both. And my understanding is that it will open that to catch it on your server, as well as if you're doing reverse, as well as having that bind on your grunt. This is why I find it confusing, because that's my reading of the documentation. Again, this could be documentation seeming strange.
I haven't read the documentation, so.
Simon just does it live. Look, we'll park that one for the moment. The listener thing is extremely odd. The UX design to have a little clicky up and down arrow button for the ports, to me, is absolutely insane. And somebody should get into the Covenant repo and fix that stat. However, there are some great things about listeners. The profiles are great. Being able to do a message transform in the middle using code. So it has like a little C2 edit box, which allows you to transform the messages that you're sending to and from, so you can make them appear as other things, which is pretty cool. And it also allows you to set like a HTML response. So you can create a profile that'll have like a little special fake web, you know, web page that you could dev up in HTML, put it in there. And then whenever you send your C2 to the server, it'll reply with that HTML code, which is great. However, I do get the sense that it may make more of a signatureable surface. So like if you're writing in a listener, you'd have to write many listeners with all sorts of different HTML in them. Because if you're putting your HTTP listeners, if you're putting HTML responses that are going back to the traffic that's coming from your implant to make it seem like it's getting a response and that response is legitimately a website on the internet rather than an implant, rather than a C2 server, then that is something else that can just be signatured. At the end of the day, HTTP comms are great because they can go almost anywhere. You know, you can get through proxies, you can get reasonably undetected, especially if you're encrypted. But in terms of signaturing, kind of raw encrypted TCP is still king, right?
I wouldn't necessarily encrypted TCP as a distinct thing from TLS. But yeah, I mean, certainly if you're going to have zero sort of outbound comms, and you're going to sort of wrap up these comms in like the shell of a HTTP session, just in case that your environment is doing break and inspect on the gateway, and you know someone is having a look inside that thing. As you say, I don't know how much more you're hoping to achieve by having your extremely limited HTML like wrappers around your encrypted messaging that sits inside that, right? Mm-hmm. So if someone is looking at their gateway logs and they see that, you know, a regular sort of message goes out to this one, you know, web server, and it's always the exact same block of HTML, except that it's got some encrypted blob in the middle of it that I don't think doesn't seem to be achieving very much, some kind of malleable, you know, HTML profile.
Yeah. And they do have that. They have what they call a bridge profile, which again in documentation seems to say it's like they only support HTTP. But the bridge profile seems to be the one where it's completely open and you can use C# to completely say whatever type of message that you want, whatever kind of transaction, you know, that you want to have for your C2 going back and forth. As long as you can write it in C#, you can put it in there, right? Which is cool. It's great that they have that in there and they allow that extensibility. I think that's very much a point in their favor, or a point in his favor, one person. So you've got info for me on that bind and connect address?
Yeah. So what Cobber has set up here is that when you go ahead and create a listener in Covenant, the bind address, which by default is 0.0.0.0, just yep. Bind to all interfaces.
Yeah, bind everything, yeah.
And then you set up a bind port. This is specifically as it relates to your current C2 server. The connect address and the connect port is information for the grunt when you go and build that grunt. And you say like, okay, well, when you go ahead and talk out, what address are you talking right. out to?
So it's the opposite direction.
Yeah, it's the opposite direction. So now this connect address could relate this to platform, or you could send it through any number of redirectors.
Whatever, yeah, redirectors.
You know,
yeah.
you choose. So, which is why when you build a grunt or an implant in this platform, you have to link it up to a listener, and that listener actually comes with, you know, the requisite information for that grunt to make its, you know, reverse connection or its connection out to the C2.
Right. Okay. All right.
However, I would very much forgive you. It is ambiguously worded, right? It's not clear what is being done. And like the fact that, you know, these fields in the HTTP very clearly like the actual variable values, because they have no spaces in them, and you know, connect port is one word, and that's so it's just going straight into whatever C# variable is receiving this input form.
Yeah, I mean, obviously your explanation makes much more sense, but yeah, it was unclear to me. I think without more testing, well, we can move on though. Yeah, the launchers. I had a look through this launchers feature that they have. I think it's pretty cool. I think that's really where the rubber hits the road for this claim that it helps highlight the security deficiencies in .NET perhaps. But, you know, for those listening, it's pretty much like a list of templates which use LOLBAS, like living off the land binaries and scripts that can execute the grunts, the implants for this organically. So you can either generate, you know, you can generate a binary, or you can generate some shellcode based upon the implant that you make. Or you can say, hey, I want, you know, a one-liner for, you know, one of these service processes, which is vulnerable to having shellcode or a kind of a one-liner stager of one of these grunts to be injected into it.
Well, I mean, vulnerable is a strong term.
Vulnerable is a strong term, but, you know, it'll take and execute it, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, and this is where, you know, Cobbers and Spectrops' experience comes to the fore. And, you know, you can see here, like, just looking, as I am right now, looking at this launches page, and we've got, you know, an install util launcher, which, you know, uses the install util binary to launch a grunt via the uninstall method, which is, you know, a method within install util that actually allows you to execute sort of, you know, custom code within Windows, where, as long as you attach
uninstall
function. Yeah. Here's how you uninstall it. Please execute this code. And, you know, or MS build, you know, which comes with .NET. So it exists on almost every Windows machine. And these little launches are, you know, great ways to, you know, sort of bypass application control. And if the .NET file path has been allowed through your, you know, your application control solution, you can then go ahead and use MS build to launch your payloads out of that.
Good ways of getting the execution step in the MITRE attack.
Yeah, frame. Yeah, and this is like, this is a totally, totally fine and good thing to include within a C2 platform.
Yeah, I think it's quite cool. You know,
what it doesn't have is any option to add custom launches in here.
No, which is strange because you can add custom versions of everything else.
Yeah, everything else is customizable in this, but the launches are kind of locked down. You can edit the code themselves. You can edit the code of these launches, which is, you know, great. But if you want to come up with your own kind of launcher, you can't sort of add it in here.
Yeah, you'd have to co-opt one of these ones. Which is strange, but that's, you know, yeah, as we said, that's a cool feature with the grunts, and the grunts are like, they're populated in the interface here based upon, you know, the templates and what executions you get. So in the grunts tab, it pretty much gives you an overview of what shells that you have, you know, what implants that you have on target, and they are made from grunt templates, and it comes with a few default ones: the grunt HTTP, grunt SMB, grunt bridge, and the brute, which, again, another good Halo reference, but which says it's a cross-platform built on .NET Core 3.1. But yeah, and these all seem good. SMB is a great way of communicating.
And so implant to implant, you know, through SMB is like, you're going to blend in with a bunch of other SMB traffic that lives within Windows domains. You see here the one of the things that is extremely common with the various types of C2 profiles, and I just thought about it looking at this grunt page, is that, you know, you have a table here with these various cells of, you know, name, hostname, user, integrity, last check-in, status, and it just sort of drives home the fact that all of these grunts are, you know, designed to work on beaconing system for comms. So all of them, like, despite the fact that you can talk sort of peer-to-peer between grunts, they will all beacon out with, you know, on a certain schedule with a certain percentage of jitter back out to your C2 server.
You set that as part of the profile. You set the jitter and you set how many times you want to try. And
yeah, which is totally fine. It's been a classic for many, many years. And as I said, you know, this tool is a few years old now. It hasn't been updated in a number of years. But I think, you know, with other tools, we're starting to see more innovation in ways of communicating rather than just having outbound beacons.
Yeah, having potentially quite a lot of them, depending on how many of these that you have around. It does allow you to specify, you know, relays and that kind of thing. So you could specify everybody to go to a relay, but everybody would have to go there. You'd have to really set something up so that you could chain it. I think the extensibility of Covenant in that, you know, in these grunt templates, like, they give you the window where you can put in the stager code and the executor code. And yeah, you could go into the back end and do it, but it is a lot easier to just have this here, so that you can generate grunts based on this template. But you could actually have you could write in C# like a proxy listener to then forward on code, and then you could have a chain. You could have a chain of listener profiles where you were sending them one to the other, and you were, you know, having implant go through implant. But it's kind of square peg round hole for this C2 framework to do that. you're pretty much starting to create your own C2 framework at that point, written in C#.
By my own C2 framework written in Covenant.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think, yeah, does have the potential to be somewhat loud as well with all of that. It is not exactly progressive. What I do like, though, is this concept of tasks, right, that you can send to the implant to do. And it's got tons of these tasks, right? Lots and lots of techniques you can use on Windows, which are templated, but also you can write yourself in, again, C#, to be able to do things like, you know, query DPA, the API, or create WMI events, or like all sorts of things, like there's heaps of them. And you can just, you know, once you've got your stager down and your implant on the target, you can just line up a bunch of these and it can just do a bunch of them, you know? And I think you've used the Safety Cats plugin with this before. You've had it actually output before it gets at Banhammer.
Yeah, yeah. So I did so a, you know, sort of short course I taught a few years ago on how to bypass Defender by checking Covenant grunts against AMSI for see where it's being detected and, you know, alter it, because, you know, this Covenant tool does allow you to full access to the source code of the grunts. So it was fairly easy to demonstrate how you could do that. And it, you know, over the, you know, course of this course, me and the people I was working with were able to get Covenant grunts executing on a up-to-date, you know, Windows Defender profile. But then once we launched these tasks, it immediately gets whacked by the Defender banhammer,
yeah.
and the agent is lost. However, like, I think, you know, I never really considered this to be a, you know, serious tool. I think is perhaps I'm being a bit harsh. Yeah, so like whether or not, you know, Cobber intended Covenant to be used in anger, or, you know, intended it to be used for, you know, for learning and legal studies or whatnot. But certainly under this tasks profile, he's included, you know, 10 or so pages of every sort of, you know, .NET and, you know, PowerShell technique available at the time.
Yeah, to do privesque or lateral movement or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. And this, like, I love to see this. I think, you know, the extensibility of this, because these tasks, they're not built into the grunts, right? The grunt is quite happy, yeah, to accept these tasks as it gets provided to them by the server and then go ahead and execute. So
it's just a bit of code and it gets pulled down, right? Everything's a stager for the next thing you want to do.
That's great. And that's a terrific way of running things.
Yeah, I mean, it has a few other things, like it has a data page where, you know, anything that's downloaded from the grunt goes there. You can create credentials so you can save things in there, and, you know, have screenshots if you're doing screen grabbing, that kind of thing. So it has a little place where you can store all that stuff, which is also pretty good, rather than it just
it's lovely to see
the TAC machine or something like that.
And yeah,
you're gonna share it.
You know, your Notepad plus 10 tabs of new files and.
Yeah, for our listeners, Simon is a monster and never saves any of his notes. He just leaves them in open, unsaved tabs.
Right. I only have a code in Notepad +++. Yeah, IDEs are for chumps.
I'm still in Vim over here. Yeah, so there's also, like, you know, users. You can create other users, make them of Covenant. I mean, and, you know, everyone can have their own theme. We love making custom themes in cyber, right? Everybody wants to have their own little... a little interface theme, you know, want to make their own little synthwave retro dark whatever thing. So it's good to see that. The default ones that they have, the secondary one, the dark one's a bit insane on the eyes. If you activate that, you'll be like, this is a bit much. But the, you know, the default light theme is nice. You can almost see it as a business application. Nobody's going to think you're hacking when you're looking at Covenant in its default state. So that's kind of funny.
I mean, you say it's a bit harsh on the eyes, but the theme template is called Heathen Mode, and it is tagged a dark theme meant for lawless heathens.
Yeah, look, you know, hard on the eyes. Lawless heathens are hard on the eyes. But yeah, all around, I think, like you say, this is it's a good C2 framework in that it has a lot of good elements. But yeah, I also question whether or not it's meant to be used in paid ops against other people. So there's a bit of a question there. We probably will decide on how to mathematically put a star rating in and then have that in our write-up of this episode. But right now, I think I'm going to give Covenant, you know, a, like, pretty good. My rating, Simon, it's pretty good.
I think it's quite good for its niche. As they said, you know, it's a tool. It's written in C#. Even the web front end is written in C#. Like the grunts are written in C#. All of the tasks are written in C#. And the whole thing is to highlight, you know, potential security vulnerabilities in .NET as a sort of niche. That's terrific. That's a great little left and right of arc that you want to sort of set for yourself. And I think it does that little niche quite well. I mean, not every C2, you know, profile out there, I think, needs to reinvent the wheel and sort of do everything for everyone. Like, if you want exploitation stuff, you know, Metasploit exists, PowerShell Empire exists, Sliver is, you know, reasonably popular at the moment. They are there, and then, you know, C2 platforms or post-exploitation C2 platforms also exist. So it is another tool for your arsenal, and, you know, it's reasonably well written, and I'm, you know, sorry to see that it seems to have been somewhat abandoned.
Yeah, I think that's a good all-round review, Simon, right? All right, I think with the review done, that is it. Thank you, everybody, for listening to our podcast. Our next episode is actually going to be a whole series of interviews live from DEF CON. So we're going to DEF CON 32, and we will be just having mad chats with Red Teamers there and seeing what they're about. So if you want to hear DEF CON podcast and then the wrap-up of our attendance there, then please tune in next time. But then the episodes will go back to normal with, you know, with our crazy ideas, our interviews with a hacker, and our review of a open source tool. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Remy, and that's Simon.
Bye, everyone.
This has been a KBI Media production.